You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Predicting future domestic and global trends can be a difficult proposition, but Daniel Franklin, executive editor of The Economist and editor of The Economist of the World in 2013, make a stab at it every year nevertheless. From global elections and Mongolian mining concerns to smart cities and emerging technologies, the world in 2013 looks at the coming year and the changes that it could bring. And we're very pleased to welcome Daniel Franklin back to our show to talk about this year's predictions. Among the people who have contributed to this edition are the new president of Mexico, the Italian prime minister, Melinda Gates. Shouldn't we assume that their predictions will be to promote their own agendas?
Well, to a certain extent, they talk about what interests them naturally, what they're engaged in. But they have interesting things to say. So Melinda Gates, for example, is talking about what she predicts will be a fall in neonatal deaths in the very poorest countries.
Well, when we're predicting, let's say, the economic outlook for the United States, doesn't it really depend on where you stand on the political spectrum? A liberal might see things very differently from a moderate, a conservative Republican, or a Tea Party member.
Well, on the United States, we have our own correspondent who's making his prediction, and so he's nonpartisan and actually relatively optimistic this year on the outlook. Of course, everything so much depends on whether the politicians do manage to negotiate the fiscal cliff. But if that happens, then the outlook is really not so bad.
Do you think that compromise might occur soon, or will it be what many people suggest, kick down the road until next year?
I think that's quite likely. What I think it will happen one way or another is that the politicians will somehow manage to avoid a 5% hit to the American economy. No one wants that. That would be terrible for America. It would also be, by the way, terrible news for the rest of the world. The rest of the world does not want to see the United States go back into recession. Everyone wants to see a vigorous, growing United States. So it matters not just for America what happens to the fiscal cliff. It matters to everyone. But I think, you know, this game of brinkmanship has been played so many times now. I think they will somehow manage to avoid disaster. And then, you know, a certain amount of confidence will come back.
Well, when you were putting this together, you couldn't know whether Barack Obama or Mitt Romney would win the election. Do you think the predictions for the United States would have been all that different if the election had gone the other way?
No, we did actually. We go to press just after the election. So we have to hope that there is a clear result. That was a bit of a problem in 2000, but this time it was known very quickly, so we were able to make some final adjustments and then print.
With a slow projected growth of the American economy in 2013 of just 2.5%, how does the impasse over the fiscal cliff and the debt ceiling affect the global economy?
Well, you say that's slow, but it's not that slow compared with Europe, which is actually looking at flat economy in the year ahead.
So, and are Europe's problems having a real impact on the United States?
Well, they would have a real impact if the euro crisis takes a sharp turn for the worse, which I think is one of the big risks for the year ahead, frankly, that the euro problems are far from over, and there are a couple of big elections coming up in Europe and other potential disruptions that could upset things. But let's just assume for a moment that doesn't happen. I think then the outlook for America after a successful negotiation of the fiscal cliff is better, because the housing market is coming back. The Fed is being reasonably accommodating as well.
But there are things you can't predict, like Hurricane Sandy, which has set things back a bit.
Absolutely, and they come along every year. They're the things that come out of nowhere, the natural disasters and so on.
And another country you make positive predictions about is the Philippines, and they just have been hit by a terrible typhoon, maybe 1,000 people dead.
That's right, terrible.
Incredible destruction.
If you look before that and then beyond that, the Philippines has had actually a remarkably successful record of very steady and quite rapid economic development in recent years. So it's one of the two countries actually in that region that we look at and say maybe these are the challenges for the position of number two behind China, challenging India, which has stumbled in its growth. And Indonesia is another very big one with a quarter of a million people hitting that threshold next year.
Now, why now? The Philippines has had a rather literate population for a long time. Indonesia is a country, well, it's had some problems in some of the islands, and there's been a little bit of some ethnic conflict. But these are countries that could just as easily have pulled it together 10 or 15 years ago.
Yes, that's right. It's partly the effect of general improvement in Asia, China pulling up other countries, but also steadier politics and, to some extent, better governance. And that certainly helps when you have the confidence in stability and a certain amount of investment-friendly government.
I'll want to talk a little later about China slowing down, but does that have an impact? Do these other countries do better because the Chinese economy is slowing down?
No, but they have an opportunity when China cost is going up. So Chinese workers are starting to be paid more, which is good for – that's what you want to see happen in a country that is growing richer, but that creates opportunities elsewhere to compete.
Isn't that what happened with Japan many years ago? The Japanese economy improved, and then suddenly the Japanese companies felt it was better to ship jobs over to Taiwan. And then Taiwan did better, and it wound up in South Korea, and then South Korea did better than China.
And there's always somewhere else waiting to take up the slack.
Vietnam now.
Vietnam and a few others, actually, interestingly. Mexico is an interesting place to look at right here close to the United States, which is becoming more and more competitive vis-a-vis China, very close to the U.S. market, so you don't have the same transport costs. So Mexico is becoming more and more competitive as a manufacturing base.
And people, as I said, you spoke to or Prieto, the new president of Mexico, was one of the contributors here. He's a member of the PRI party, which pretty much ran Mexico for 75, 80, I don't know how many years, but a very long time, much of the 20th century, and eventually was booted out because of corruption and because of a semi-authoritarian approach. Are we assured that they're not going to return to that?
Well, there's no guarantee, but the good news is that there have now been two smooth, peaceful transitions of power from one political family to another. That the big thing was, as you say, the first time after 75 years, the best part of a century, the PRI party ran the country.
And they stole a few elections.
And even these past elections were disputed, but not, funnily enough, by the PRI this time, but by the far-left party.
My guest is Daniel Franklin, executive editor of The Economist. We're talking about an annual publication of The Economist, this one, The World in 2013, in which predictions are made about things happening all over the world. And you mentioned Europe. The elections coming up, Germany will have elections in September. So this is going to be a long lead up to that. But how important to the European Union is Angela Merkel and the possibility that she might be voted out of office?
Well, Angela Merkel and Germany generally is emerging as the dominant or the key player in the whole European saga. The German economy has done better than the other big economies in Europe. Nothing really can happen without German say-so. Germany controls the purse strings. So people have been looking increasingly to Angela Merkel to see how far she is prepared to move to support the weaker economies in the Eurozone. And she is going to have her eye on the voters back home for the best part of the year, which is going to restrict what she's able to do and the boldness, if you like, with which she's able to act at the European level.
And there have been a number of sick economies in the EU, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, but Greece is the one that people are most worried about. Is it possible that Greece could be kicked out of the EU?
I think that there was a decision taken, and partly this again comes back to Angela Merkel. There was a lot of talk some months ago about whether this would happen and whether indeed it might be quite a good thing for the euro if Greece was kicked out, because it's really not in a fit state to be in this single currency union. I think then at that moment Germany decided, no, this would be a disaster. This would be deeply destabilizing. And so they decided to keep Greece in. But Greece is, in 2013, entering its sixth successive year of recession. It's really painful situation. And the vulnerability there is not so much from the government, which is trying to do the right things, but from the street and the possibility that some sort of popular anger will just burst forth, given the social strains that there are.
Well, there are a lot of people who would like to withdraw from the EU, but what would that mean for Greece? Return to the drachma? What would that mean?
It would be a tremendous economic shock. A lot of companies would go bankrupt. It seems that it might be attractive because you could walk away perhaps from some of the debts and so on, but straight away people would feel an extreme shock and disruption. It would be the end of a dream of being part of the mainstream of Europe.
Well, Iceland was the sick child a few years back. Have they pulled themselves out of their terrible dilemma?
They were never part of the euro, so to that extent they had a different set of issues.
But they were tied to the European economy.
They were tied to the European economy, but they were always a small economy. They did a better negotiation on their debt, and they didn't bring with them the same questions of holding the eurozone together. Ireland is actually a better example of a country that is part of the eurozone, had a huge banking bust, and is actually an encouraging example of an economy that's actually starting to come back.
Argentina refused to pay off much of its debt, and everybody said that was a brilliant move, and now we're seeing people try to get back to Argentina. So it may take a few years, but any of these countries may very well feel the effects 5 or 6 years down the line.
That's the astonishing thing, that this is not just an immediate problem. It's a problem for the long-term future.
Jeff, one of our listeners in West Orange, left this question on our show page. Why is growth for growth's sake such a holy grail? We cannot sustain perpetual growth indefinitely. It's a dangerous objective. Why isn't maintenance a goal?
Well, I think obviously you want sustainable growth, and there is a concern over growth that mortgages the future. But I think we've seen in recent years that non-growth is painful. Non-growth creates real economic hardship, brings with it losses of jobs, brings with it the destruction of dreams. And I think we've seen that at least a sustainable level of growth for a country like the United States is something that most people really want and desire.
Although I suspect Jeff is responding to what we saw with the housing bubble, where it was just assumed that the values of real estate would keep on going up. And, of course, at a certain point, it burst. And look at the dilemma we are in now.
Absolutely. And I think that's an example of something that was clearly, plainly not sustainable. And in fact, not myself, but colleagues at The Economist were saying this for quite some time, that this was clearly going to end in tears. And the only question was when it would happen.
My guest is the executive editor of The Economist and editor of an annual publication of The Economist called The Economist, The World in 2013. Last year it was 2012. He's come to our show a number of times to make predictions. Some of them have panned out pretty well. There was one year, I think 2008, that was a total disaster for your predictions. We talked about that the next year. But I suspect most of these predictions are going to pretty much pan out unless something terrible happens, because you've already taken into account factors like global warming and climate change and things of that sort. Anyway, we'll continue our conversation and invite your comments on our show page at wnyc.org right after this. We are back with Daniel Franklin, executive editor of The Economist magazine, editor of the annual The World in the Coming Year, in this case The World in 2013, with contributions by Michael Porter, Enrique Pena Nieto, Nassim Taleb, Mario Monti, Melinda Gates, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, a whole bunch of important people and editors of the economists themselves. Predictions are that the coming year is going to be the one when mobile devices will replace PCs as the way that we are most likely to connect to the internet.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting turning points where internet connections, devices that are mobile, so smartphones, tablet computers, for the first time outnumber PC computers, fixed connections. And it's just a mind-concentrating moment where you actually see a hard measure of how the internet is going mobile, and that has all sorts of consequences.
Well, will that affect businesses? Because most people work with PCs in the office, and then they use the mobile devices at home. Or
I think it does affect. It affects, first of all, the businesses that provide services for the internet. So some of those businesses are very well placed for this mainly mobile world. Apple is one of them. You can see its products being very. Its mobile products being particularly popular. And then there are others, those that are producers for the fixed internet world, Dell, HP, they are going to have more problems adjusting.
Because a company like Apple, which was struggling for a while, understood that this was going to happen, or maybe, in fact, forced the issue, and other companies that didn't figure it out have paid the price.
And then you see some companies that are in between the two. So Facebook is a good example of that. It was developed for a fixed internet world and is having to move very smartly to try and make sure that it can prosper in a mobile world.
At the Economist Gala last night, you spoke with Eric Schmidt, the chairman of Google. What did he predict?
Well, he was also talking about lots of these products that are mobile, mainly mobile products.
But Google's also trying to get on board.
Google's trying to get on board. It has prototypes, for example, of computer glasses, wearable computing, if you like. So that's certainly a trend that's coming in the future. And all sorts of extraordinary devices that are technology-enabled, including translation devices he was talking about.
And he's very proud of how Google's self-driven car has been working.
Although that sounds like a bit of a scary experience first time around.
Also, for the average consumer, these things are years away. In fact, there were predictions that we would see more electric cars than we have. There's been a certain amount of consumer resistance despite all of the positive talk about these cars. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think as regards driverless cars, which is one of the technologies we were talking about yesterday, that's very early stage. It's still test phase and won't be actually on the roads.
Although he said it was safer
for many years.
And quicker.
Yes, safer and quicker, but it'll take a lot of testing and then convincing, I think, that we can rely on technology in that area. What the pattern that often happens with these technology breakthroughs is that there's a lot of hype in the first stage. People say this is completely revolutionary. And then nothing much seems to happen for a while. And it's only later that things start to change and can change very rapidly. And you say, yes, actually, this was revolutionary. It just came along 10 years after we thought it was going to come along.
Globally speaking, who'll be the big winners in 2013? You mentioned Mongolia.
Well, in terms of countries that are growing particularly fast, you have to look at some surprising places. So, yes, the country that we forecast is going to be the fastest growing in the world is Mongolia, which has giant mines coming on stream, copper and gold mines. And when such a large investment happens in a relatively small country and starts to produce, it has a very big impact on growth. And this is a country, actually a large country in area, but a small country, just 3 million people in population, but with very great interest from the mining industry. And some of the other countries, Macau, for example, very small economy again, but its gaming industry is now huge, bigger than Las Vegas. And it's benefiting from the new rich in China playing the casinos there.
Well, China's playing a role in Mongolia. After all, part of Mongolia was controlled by China in the first place, and they are deeply involved in the mining, which is causing some problems for the Mongolian government. China is also getting involved in mining in Afghanistan, a country you don't predict will do all that well in the coming year, despite the fact that it has all these natural resources.
Well, some countries do well when they're post-conflict and have a degree of stability. So among the other fast growers, two of the countries that are going to be right up there are Iraq and Libya. So when a country has had its growth very sharply suppressed during a period of difficulty and conflict. When that ends and people feel secure again, they can bounce back very fast. And Afghanistan isn't quite there yet, I think.
Well, that worked. It worked that way for China, but it didn't work that way for Spain after the fall of Franco.
Although Spain had some very good years in the 1990s and 2000, the Spanish boom was extraordinary, and of course, that makes the latest problems that Spain has been experiencing all the more painful.
Will Britain, your country, continue its slide?
Britain is in a tricky situation. It's had a double-dip recession. That's not been fun. It's had, in some ways, a good year this year with the Olympics and royal festivities and so on. But we have growth as the biggest problem, or the lack of growth. And the fact that we are connected, our main trading partner is the European Union, which has all these problems and is now in recession. That holds us back a lot.
What about the scandals? The scandals at the Murdoch newspapers and now all of these sex scandals?
Well, we've just had a big press report, the so-called Leveson report. So there's been a lot of soul searching by the press, particularly looking at the tabloid press. So the big question that Britain is wrestling with in the next few months is what sort of regulation should be put in place to improve things. Will it be self-regulation, or will there be some sort of legislation?
And as long as we're making predictions, will Kate have a boy or a girl?
Well, let's just hope it's a healthy baby, but that's going to be the most watched baby of 2013, that's for sure.
Well, there was a little cartoon in the Financial Times in which somebody's looking at a newspaper headline and says, oh, another mouth to feed.
Well, who knows? Maybe she'll have both a boy and a girl.
My guest is Daniel Franklin, editor of The Economist and editor of The World in 2013, the annual publication of The Economist, which predicts what's likely to happen in the upcoming year. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Okay, let's talk about China. What's on the horizon for China in the coming year? Will Xi Jinping, who's set to take over as China's president, affect any major changes?
Well, first of all, there is going to be a lot of close watching of how this drawn-out transition goes. I mean, he's already taken over as party leader. It's a multi-stage process. It's only in the spring that he takes over the state roles, and the leadership is then fully changed. And the question will be, people will be watching, is how quickly does power, real power, flow to him, and whether he will do anything significantly different from the old regime. There's a lot of talk about continuity and expectations of continuity, but in fact, new leaders always mean subtle changes. So there'll be a lot of whatever the Chinese equivalent of Kremlinology is, looking for any signs of change.
Well, some people were hoping that there would be a more liberal government put in place, kind of like a Gorbachev transition. But Xi Jinping is really allied with the old conservative establishment. So what will that mean in other areas? For example, Chinese foreign policy. Is there a danger that there'll be a serious conflict breaking out over China's claims to much of the South China Sea area?
I think there is that risk, and he will be under pressure to show that he is no pushover, to establish his authority, and also to establish popularity back home. It's very tempting to play on these disputes, the easy nationalism that's easy to stir up at a time when there are big social strains in China. We think of China as a place of very rapid growth, which it is, but it's also a country of seething social pressures.
And after 2 years of seeing its GDP growth fall, I'm assuming he's going to be expected to do something to get the economy going again.
Yes, well, China still has growth rates that would be the envy of almost everywhere else.
But it started
still 7%,
so low.
The fact is, you're right, these double-digit growth rates that had become almost the norm in recent years are a thing of the past. I think the good news for Xi Jinping next year is that there is quite a good chance that the corner has been turned in the current slowdown, and that we could be looking at growth of around 8.5% next year, which would be quite respectable.
The Chinese image was hurt because there were a number of fires and other disasters in its manufacturing plants. Now we saw something similar in Bangladesh with Walmart and a few other American companies being blamed to some degree for being part of the cause. So how is that going to play out globally?
Well, I think these questions of product safety and of workers' safety in factories around the world are incredibly sensitive and important, and they're no longer things that can be hidden. When there are problems, they tend to come out one way or another. So part of the issue actually that faces Western multinationals operating in those countries is that they have to be aware, as never before, of practices right throughout their supply chains, and they have to get much better at making sure. We've seen company after company being caught in this, making sure that reasonable practices are being followed, and you have to go back not just to your immediate suppliers but the suppliers of your suppliers to make sure that that things aren't going to turn bad.
There are people concerned about what's going to happen with Christians in Syria if that revolution succeeds. We've been seeing random killings of Shiites in Pakistan without the government doing anything much to stop them. What do you think? Is this going to be a tough year for Christians and religious minorities in the Middle East?
Well, in the Middle East and actually in Western Europe, I think we have a leading article arguing that this will be one of the worst years ever for Christians in those parts of the world. It's been for very different reasons. In the Anglican Church, for example, there are very deep divisions and arguments over the question of women bishops.
Same-sex marriage.
Same-sex marriage as well. That's an issue in many countries. And then in the Middle East, as you say, the question of the ability of Christians in many countries to practice their faith is in question, and there is a prospect that perhaps an exodus of Christians from some countries could happen because of real fears of persecution.
And now we have continued tension, I guess nothing new, between Israel and its neighbors. It doesn't look likely that that problem is going to be resolved in 2013.
No, and here again the question comes somewhat back to the United States and what role is the newly re-elected Obama administration willing to play in the Middle East, because there will be no answer there without very strong American engagement. But in his first term, Barack Obama briefly got involved and then seemed to step back because presumably he thought there was no great upside for him in putting too much political capital there.
He also was reluctant to support the Syrian rebellion. Earlier, we treaded very lightly in Egypt because people were concerned that with the overthrow of the governments, we would see a more of a Islamist approach to government. And we are seeing that in Egypt, for example.
Well, we're seeing now that President Morsi has overreached very badly and is feeling the consequences with a response to that. I think the really hard case for American policy and Western policy generally at the moment is Syria. You know, there's a terrible civil war going on. What should the West do? Should the West be more interventionist? And if so, in what way?
And that also applies to the growth of al-Qaeda in other areas, in Mali and in Yemen and elsewhere.
Yes, the al-Qaeda challenge has shifted geographically, and we have an article looking at that, particularly in Mali and the way that this has spread in a particularly lawless area. And that I think is at least the problem is acknowledged, and it's increasingly seen as something that has to be acted on.
An interesting section in this issue is where to be born in 2013. How do you determine that? And Switzerland is the best place?
Yes. Well, 25 years ago, we did this exercise, or rather our colleagues at the Economist Intelligence Unit did this exercise, and they did it in a very lighthearted manner. They looked at all sorts of factors, not just economic well-being, but also, for example, the quality of chocolate. If you have particularly good chocolate, you would get bonus points. And if a country seemed too boring, you would get points deducted and so on. This time it was a much more serious exercise, again by the Economist Intelligence Unit. They have a quality of life index that looks at the things people say matter to them. And they put the numbers into the computer, and out came Switzerland as number one.
And where does the United States rank?
Back in 16th place out of the 80 countries measured, which perhaps will surprise some. It's still high up, but there are things that people say matter to them for quality of life include safety, sense of family values, low crime, and so on. And those are the sorts of things that the United States scores less well than some other countries.
There was, during the presidential campaign, debate over energy independence. Do you think we'll become more energy independent in 2013? I'm thinking especially about the presidential debate, which dealt with the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada to the United States. Could be important for Canada as well.
It could, and the whole energy economy of the United States is changing extraordinarily rapidly. We just saw the other day a report from one of the main international bodies on energy saying that the United States would be the leading oil producer in the world again in a few years' time, and of course the gas... Over Saudi Arabia and Russia. Those are the two countries it's behind at the moment. And gas, the gas from the fracking industry from unconventional sources has been an astonishing change. So all of a sudden, energy independence for America, or more likely North America generally, if you count Canada as well, is a very real prospect.
So what are you, overall, what is your sense? Should we be optimistic about the upcoming year?
Well, you know, there are some people who are afraid of any year with the number 13 in it, which is unlucky for some. There's a word for that, triskaidekaphobia, fear of the number 13.
I can imagine when we have Friday the 13th in 2013.
Absolutely. And so
the Mayans might be afraid.
I think we have, well, if we get there at all, of course, but if I think that there are grounds to be a bit apprehensive about the economy and about some of these risks that you've been talking about, but it's all potentially surmountable, particularly the immediate economic problems here. So I think if we're lucky, disaster doesn't quite strike and it ends up being just another difficult year of recovery.
And many people are predicting that the Tea Party will lose a lot of its clout in this country, one of the reasons Jim DeMint has decided to leave the Senate.
Well, clearly the Republicans have some hard thinking to do, and you know, the electoral cycle is always with us in America, so there'll be a lot of speculation about who and what sort of Republican Party for next time round.
Daniel Franklin is executive editor of The Economist and editor of The Economist's The World of 2013. Fascinating reading, and I thank you so much for coming by to talk about it.
Thank you. Pleasure.